So, Monsieur, when my book on my family came out, that was The Hair with Amber Eyes, I was asked about faith. In America, with some directness, I was asked, are you coming back? Some asked about the children, and I deflected. And my father is a half-Jewish Anglican clergyman. My mother is the daughter of a country vicar, a historian. I've been brought up in the Church of England in cathedrals. I've written about the Quakers. I read Zen Buddhist poetry. I love the Psalms as they cross over everything, our proper poems of exile. I'm half English, quarter Dutch, a quarter Austrian, and completely European.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by the author and artist Edmund Duval, known to Norwegian readers for his book The Hair with the Amber Eyes, an artist who writes. We're going to discuss his latest book, Letters to Commando. On your homepage, I can read something. Much of your work is about the contingency of memory, bringing particular histories of loss and exile into renewed life. So before we start, Edmund, I think it's okay for the readers to know what this book is all about. It's called Letters to Commando, and Commando, he is a nobility living in Paris, and he lives in this huge, huge house that he's built in the middle of Paris, filled with furniture, art, and everything you can think of. And you are writing letters to him because he died many years ago, before the war. And the house is also today a museum. And you are exploring his house. And also by doing that, you are exploring his life. And it's very interesting to see how it's possible to write letters to a person who's dead, but still in his letters, he comes to life. And of course, it's a special reason why you do this, because he is a relative of yours, and his family, they were Jews, and they all perished in Holocaust during the war. So this is the special story that you are looking into in Letters to Commando. And as readers might know, you wrote the book, as I mentioned, The Hair with the Amber Eyes. And I said that you were an artist who writes. And to many, you are also known as an artist doing ceramics, doing porcelain, doing lovely things with your hands. So that is also part of what you're doing. But here we're talking about your book, and you are then also a writer. And let me start with a quote from one of your letters that I greatly appreciated. And you may read it, of course.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you today. A dense, grey, velvety dust, like a soft coat of felt, its colour and texture seemingly providing the unifying element for these tall bottles and deep bowls. It was a dust that was not the result of negligence and untidiness, but of patience, a witness to complete peace. The dust that covered them was like a mantle of nobility.
It's beautiful. And dust is also part of your artistic work. So are you trying to remove this dust and discover what's underneath it very carefully?
That's a lovely idea, but no.
You're not trying to do that.
I don't believe in removing dust. I think I'm trying to find where the dust has settled most intensely in the world. So I'm trying to find the places where things haven't been disturbed. And that's often, of course, in hidden histories and in this case, in this new book, in archives. And then sort of, really, I'm sort of rather passionate about dust. So I, rather than sort of blow the dust off and kind of shake it all down and vacuum it all up and hoover it away, I suppose it's really taking the time to kind of measure the dust carefully in where it is in the world.
Because when dust is underneath something, you know that it's been there for a long time.
Yeah, you can. Your time has passed, and you can see that time has passed. You can, you're aware of that feeling that something has been let alone in the world. Has been alone in the world. Has been often abandoned in the world, and that sometimes can be very beautiful. I mean, the passage I just read is, of course, it's a description by an art historian. Of going to see Morandi, the great artist Morandi's studio, where in Bologna, where all his beautiful pots and vessels were covered in dust, and that can be very beautiful. But it can also be, of course, a marker of abandonment of histories, which are really difficult and painful, and have histories which you may not know quite why things have been left where they are.
Mm. And that is the intriguing thing about your book here, because the dust hair covers something beautiful, lots of beautiful things, but it also covers a very, very sad story in many ways. So Musée Nissim de Camondo, which is, I mean, the house that you are describing, it belonged to a relative of yours, a neighbor probably also, of one of your family, the Effrissi family in Paris. It's a beautiful house. It houses the late 19th century art filled in there, few furniture, and also a house that this owner, his son, was going to inherit it, but this didn't happen. So why did you become interested in this Camondo family and especially his house that now is a museum?
Okay, I could answer that very straightforwardly. Why shouldn't I be interested in an extraordinary house of cousins, Jewish cousins of my family who lived just 10 doors away from where my family lived in Paris? Why shouldn't I be completely besotted, amazed, intrigued, haunted by a place which has been untouched since it was given in 1936 by Moïse de Camondo, this extraordinary collector, to the French state after his death? Why wouldn't I be intrigued by this great theatrical performance of this house, this beautiful house filled with furniture and porcelain and bronzes and tapestries and art, all laid out in a very particular way, all with this very strong feeling that nothing should be moved. His will, he says, nothing in my house will ever be moved. But there's this house, and then upstairs in the attics, this extraordinary, dusty series of rooms with archives beyond belief and cupboards with broken furniture and pieces of luggage and old light fittings that have been there since 1936 as well. How could you not? How could I not, as a person who cares about all this stuff, try and work out what this place means?
Because, well, the story goes there that this relative of yours, he bought the house, he moved to France, he installed himself in this beautiful house with his son, and he made an extraordinary place to live. But he was Jewish, and he was living in France, but before the First World War.
So yes, the family, Jewish family from Constantinople, they arrive in Paris exactly the same time my family arrives from Odessa in Ukraine. And their families build huge houses just on the edge of the Parc Monceau. Lots of Jewish families do. They all intermarry. They all collect, and they're all involved in the arts and literature. And Moïse de Camondo, the extraordinary man who builds this house and collects, he's collecting it for his son and for his daughter. His son dies in the First World War. He's a good French boy. He volunteers for the, to join up during the war, and is killed in a flying accident in 1917. And immediately, the whole meaning of this house changes for Moise to come onto. It becomes a memorial for his son, his lost son. And he decides that he's going to make this house and collection and give it to France. He's, you know, it's a great story of assimilation. You know, they've just moved from Constantinople, but he's become French, he's become Parisian, and he wants to give something to France as a marker of his French son and as a way of proving how devoted he is to French culture.
Mm. And that we're going to see what happens because, you're writing letters then to a person that cannot answer, obviously, yes. Because, well, he died in 1936.
Well, you say obviously, but actually, to be honest, actually, Mathilde, the strange thing is, it's only when I picked up the finished copy of my book when it came out, because, of course, I realized that there's silence all the way through the book, because, of course, he doesn't write back. I kind of, bizarrely enough, I hadn't registered quite, you know, the feeling of that until I'd got the finished book in my hands. But no, he doesn't write back. Sorry.
Yes, no, he doesn't write back. But anyway, it doesn't really matter when you read the book, because through your letters, you gradually get the feeling that you are coming to know this man, you're coming to know his house, you're coming to know all the things that he'd done, because he has left all his ideas, his life in all these objects that you are looking at and all the things that you are seeing, how he's placed them, how he has the chair, how he has his desk, how he has almost, I would say, everything in the house.
It's so powerful because, you know, you can go to a place and you can think it's just a sort of collection of inanimate objects that have been just brought together and that's that. But it's not that. It's really not that. This is the thinking through by someone who's very kind of interesting and interested in the world of how to make a place which reflects culture, a culture of tolerance and a culture of inquiry, the great 18th century Enlightenment, French Enlightenment. And that's what he's doing. He's making a house which reflects that beautifully. And it's the kind of house where he's sort of waiting. He's a lonely old man as well. He's sort of waiting for Voltaire to walk up the stairs and join him, you know. And that's the feeling of the house that he creates.
Yes, and I mean your mission of doing this will, to the reader at least, and also probably to you, will show that you are taking care of these memories. You are making a story out of it. And this one, I guess, for visitors to the museum, they will get much more out of it by reading your book because you are making it alive.
Yes, I mean, this. There are reasons why this matters to me, which we may come to.
Yes, of course, you can start by those reasons.
Which is that, I mean, this is the house of cousins and my grandmother living in Paris in the early 1920s and then bringing my father and uncle up there in the late 1920s, used to visit her cousin, Beatrice, who's the daughter of the collector. And Moise de Camondo dies in 1936 and gives the house, and it becomes a hugely successful, popular museum for Parisians. They love it. They go and see this extraordinary house. It's like walking into an 18th century mansion. And that's 1936. Mm. And in 1940, the Wehrmacht walk into Paris unopposed, as we know. And the first edicts from Vichy France are promulgated before the invasion, and then day by day by day, the Jewish population of France are stripped of their possessions, their dignity, and then their livelihoods, and then ultimately, you know, their lives. Mm. And Beatrice Camondo and her husband and their two children are taken in to the concentration camp on the edge of Paris, Drancy, guarded as we know, by French policemen. And eventually they are deported to Auschwitz, where they're murdered.
Mm.
So, you know, but the house is intact. The collection is intact. The museum is intact. It's not looted by the Nazis because it's a French cultural property. It's just nothing to do with the Jews. It's just kept intact. And so you have this unbelievably painful disjuncture, this separation between this beautiful house, family house, and the fact that the family do not exist at all. And how do you make sense of that? How do you begin to talk about that, uncover it, tell the story, walk through it, find the dust?
That's what you've done.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Well, I think you've done it. So I was going to ask you if you think it was good that was the commando who died in 36 and gave his house, as you said, to the French state because he felt so French in a way. And how would you... He didn't experience this He didn't know.
No.
And do you think that was good for him?
Well, I mean...
It's counterfactual, of course.
It's counterfactual because I'm very, very conscious at this moment of my great-grandfather, Victor Evrissi, who saw the destruction and looting of our family in Austria, in Vienna, saw his wife, my great-grandmother, commit suicide, managed to escape, died in 1945 as a refugee, not knowing who had survived and who hadn't survived the camps. So, I don't know how one ever kind of moves through this. I think what I try and do in the book, in my letters to him, is to you know, my letters are sort of, well, they're very, you know, they're all kinds of letters to him. They're amused and interrogative and pleased, and they're sometimes a little cross, and we share things. I kind of ask him things, all kinds of stuff. I sort of get to know him and want to find out more about him and talk to him about all kinds of things that matter to both of us. And then I have to tell him, you know, what happens to his family. And in some ways, in doing that, I'm also talking, of course, to my great-grandfather, who's exactly the same age, sort of talking to them both, really, about belonging, you know, what it is to belong and what it is to be in a place.
I think in a way, when you visit these places, I know also that you have been visited your family's house in Vienna, where they also lived. And I'd like to ask you, are you angry or sad? Or what are your feelings when you visit these places and think about these stories, and especially the one in Vienna where people were thrown out? And that's a reference to, of course, the other book that you wrote, because there were some pieces, small things that were saved.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm very conflicted about Vienna.
Yes.
And I the extraordinary thing about writing The Hair with Amber Eyes and then having it published in German in Austria was that I managed, you know, I did my book launch in the Palais Frissi, in our family house. And my father was there. And my family were there. My children were there. You know, and my father, who is now 94, but it's 10 years ago, had always said that he didn't remember anything about Vienna. There was nothing to do. There was no point in going back. I saw him, you know, after I had done my speech, you know, take my two boys up to show them his bedroom, you know. And I thought, well, you know, that's a kind of restitution. Mm. That's a kind of bringing back, which isn't on anyone else's terms. It's not a government or politics or money or art or anything else like that. It's bringing a story back. And that's the most important thing. You know, this is by far the most important thing. You know, what else is there? You know, what else is there? Mm. So, you know, I can be all kinds of, I can be aggrieved or cross or whatever about stuff, but actually I kind of think I know what I'm doing, you know, on that level.
But, well, you go back to the house, you go back to a nicer place, Paris again. Mm. The house is alive, conserved in aspic.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
How do you write and create stories from pieces of art, sculptures, paintings, architecture you observed? An example follows. Mm. I finally understood what this house is about, you write. This is this extraordinary attempt to make one space after another work without discomfort or falsity. You want to make a perfect stage set for conversation, enlightenment, and as you said, when Voltaire comes, for that moment when French culture is at its most refined, most searching. So you are using all the things, because you're an artist as well, so you have an eye for objects, obviously, and for creation of things in another way with your hands, but you still use your eyes when you do that, and your mind, of course, but writing is something else. So how do you make stories out of these pieces?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know. It's just that, you know what, the world of things is very alive for me. It's very, very alive for me. And it's the world of made objects of other people's hands, other people's thoughts, and concern about how to bring things into beautiful creation. And so when I'm in the Musée Nissim de Camondo, you know, I don't like 18th century French furniture. You know, I really don't. I'm not big on Sèvres porcelain. But you know what? I can pick it up. I can handle it. I can understand it. I can look at veneer, the way in which, you know, things are inlaid in beautiful woods, and think, and actually think about it, what's going on. And that is the beginnings of telling a story. You know, actually in The Hell with Amber Eyes, I say, you know, you put an object down in front of you, you begin to tell a story. And in that sense, you know, the power of objects is latent. You know, you can avoid it. Lots of people do. Most of the world isn't remotely concerned with porcelain. But actually, for me, that's the beginning of something. Mm. You know, and certainly with Camondo, I try and, you know, I'm not an antique dealer.
No.
I'm not a connoisseur, but I do love things.
But, well, let us have a question that I also asked Daniel Mendelssohn. He's also a Jew. Mm. And I talked to him about a year ago.
He's a terrific writer.
About his latest book.
Yeah.
And the main question is, what is the difference between history and stories? And history in the sense of history, as we know, history from school or from university or from people working with history. And he once said that history is only an increasing number of details, but emotional information cannot be measured, he said. And psychologically, I've often heard that if you tell a story, this is what is remembered. The story, not all the facts, the details. And you say history is happening. It isn't the past, it's a continuing unfolding of the moment. It unfolds in your hands. That is why objects carry so much. So in a way, do you understand, you, because these things that you are writing about, the Jews, what happened to the Jews during the war, Second World War, what, how they lived in Paris, how they were great art collectors. They were artists, as you said, many, many things. This is part of history, in a way, French history, also Austrian history, or Vienna history. And but you are telling stories out of these history facts.
Yes, and I think there's, I mean, Daniel is absolutely right about the fact that people don't remember facts, but they can remember the sort of the emotional weight of telling a story, and it's surely part of that is the full attempt to bring back the complicated lives of people who have been forgotten. I mean, that's, you know, who've been overlooked, who have been, you know, are barely a footnote, if that, in history books. So it's that trying to re-inhabit spaces where people have been that I think is the bizarre thing that I seem to do in my writing. You know, but it is the unfinishedness, the unfinishing nature of it, the unfolding nature of it, which really affects me. So I have recently, you know, in America, people said, you know, why do you go on about it? You know, isn't enough, you know, haven't you, why? And for me, it's just unfinished. It's unfinished because it's complicated and facile and in some ways the act of storytelling is a kind of witness, and therefore is unfinishable, I suppose. Mm. If I'm getting all my tenses muddled up here, but I think you know what I'm trying to say.
Yes, I understand. And when you mentioned Odessa here, and we are in the middle of a war with Ukraine, so history in itself, if it doesn't repeat itself, many of the things that we see, refugees, people losing their houses, losing their homes, being killed. Yeah. And when you read the news, it's like, okay, this many people were killed today, and you don't, well, you can't really understand that. It's a number.
Yes.
It's a big number or a small number, but it's a number. But then you go into back and see, what is this about? And that's why you get so huge reactions when you saw what's happened in Bushra, is it? Outside Kiev.
Yeah.
Because that were suddenly people lying there. It was suddenly a son. It was, you know, luggage. It was things that you might recognize as well when you go and visit Auschwitz, for instance.
And you know, the sight of people, you know, desperately trying to, you know, cross a border, you know, has to be one of, you know, has to be a living memory for people in Europe. You know, all those people who were prevented from escaping and from preventing from migrating or crossing borders, you know, is something which remains a real thing today. You know, as you say, it's all happening now.
So writing about Jews and their experiences is something a German writer did, and you mentioned maybe this little special feeling of having your book translated into German. And the German I'm thinking about is Winfried Sebald. He did it, and he also has this project about, you know, writing stories, and then suddenly you understand that he is writing about the Jew. He's and many Jews in many of his stories, and especially in ones called Austerlitz. And Austerlitz is a small boy, and he was saved by, he was sent by a train by his parents to England, and he grew up in Wales, but he didn't know anything where he came from, even not his name. So and then it ends up, of course, that Sebald is going back and going back and going back and finding his parents, and especially a very intriguing story about Theresienstadt that I saw that you visited just a while ago. I saw on Instagram that you posted a photo. And you also quote him. So I'm just thinking, how do you think about a German writing this very Jewish stories in some way? And is that possible, or is it...
It is totally... With Sebald, everything is possible.
Yes, of course. You know, he's a special person.
He was. Extraordinary. And so, I mean, Sebald's way of voicing other people in his fictions is extraordinary. I mean, also The Emigrants is another extraordinary book. Austerlitz is extraordinary. And in fact, I was, of course... You mentioned that I was in Theresienstadt a month ago, and in fact... I was there because some of my family was, a great number of my family actually had passed through Theresienstadt on their way to the camps, and some died there. And I was there, actually, I can tell you, because I was there to try and find the site of a library. There was a library that was set up in the ghetto of Theresienstadt.
Did you find it?
No. So I have to go back. But actually, it's, you know, returning to this idea of dust. You know, there's this lost library, a place where people who were on the edge of the abyss went to read books. And it's somehow, it's a place I just, and a story that I feel I'm just having to travel into just for the next journey of my life.
Next journey and next book project, because of course we're coming, as you said, back to dust. And in this case, I'm not shivering, but I'm thinking about all the dust, maybe ashes. That, I mean, it's very close connection to this dust thing and dust that you don't want to think about.
Yes, dust and ashes are ashes are a redeemed subject, a substance, says Sebald, and it's a complicated and a complicated way of thinking about it. You get hijacked by places or by people. They can be living, they can be long dead, but then you have to sort of walk in their footsteps or visit the place, and then years of your life are suddenly in abeyance until you've worked out a little bit more about what this means, what they meant, their footsteps. And so, you know, that's how books happen, isn't it?
That's why they are so powerful.
Yes. And you even sometimes write letters and wait for the response of someone who died 80 years ago.
Yes, it's beautifully done. We'll have to ask you before you go to read your favorite passage. I gave you mine. Well, there's many in there. It's many, many lovely passages. But do you have one that you could read to us from these letters?
Well, can I read you just from the very last letter when I'm trying to work out a little bit about who I am?
Of course.
Is that all right? I'm going to read it in English rather than Norwegian.
No,
if that's all right
not
with you.
Norwegian. You have to read it in English.
So, Monsieur, when my book on my family came out, that was The Hair with Amber Eyes, I was asked about faith. In America, with some directness, I was asked, are you coming back? Some asked about the children, and I deflected. And my father is a half-Jewish Anglican clergyman. My mother is the daughter of a country vicar, a historian. I've been brought up in the Church of England in cathedrals. I've written about the Quakers. I read Zen Buddhist poetry. I love the Psalms as they cross over everything, our proper poems of exile. I'm half English, quarter Dutch, a quarter Austrian, and completely European. I'm not sure what I'm coming back to. The statement, ce que nous sommes, becomes a question. My father, born in Amsterdam, raised in Paris, Vienna, the Tyrol, a refugee in 1939, has been told his application to become an Austrian citizen has been successful. It is 82 years since he left Vienna. But where do I belong? I use porcelain, which is a migratory material. It has come a long way. I make things that are susceptible to breakage. I stand up and tell stories. I write, but now when I write, I think of palimpsests, the writing over of one text by another, and I seem to spend a lot of time in archives. I think I'm a mongrel. I'm a lapsed everything. But I do know what commitment to an idea looks like. I know that there are ways of making something extraordinary out of dispersion, and that this is a way of saying something, of countering the silence of disdain. I think you can love more than one place. I think you can move across a border and still be a whole person. And so I sit here in this beautiful room with the carpet of the Golden Winds under my feet, on the edge of the Parc Monceau in Paris, and think ce que nous sommes, that you can make a place a home, and that there is honour in that. And I think that this is witness. This is what I am coming back to. I can sense autumn, and I think friend.
Lovely. Thank you so much for joining me. It was lovely to talk to you today.
It was absolutely a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation. I've loved every minute.
So Edmond de Waal's book is available, of course, from Press Forlag. His latest is Brev til Kommando. And if you like Liberal Halvtime that you've just listened to, rate us and recommend us, of course. And give us feedback using my email, matilda@civita.no, or my colleague's email, eirik@civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne medier.